Thank you so much for joining us in this special edition of Positively Revolting Talk Radio. Remember, KBOO is featured in this year's Give Guide. Support the station that you love with a tax-deductible contribution. Go to kboo.fm for more info.
People running for cover, not knowing whether they're dead or alive. They came with their tanks and their planes, with ravaging fiery flames, and nothing remains. Just a voice rising up in the smoky haze. We will not go down in the night without a fight. You can burn up our mosques and our homes and our schools, but our spirit will...
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland, unless otherwise noted. The Community Advisory Board will meet Tuesday, November 20th at 6 p.m.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor The Lyric Project Season 2, How to Say Goodbye, on Monday, November 19th at 7 p.m. at the Star Theater in Portland. The Lyric Project Season 2, How to Say Goodbye, is a multimedia event and love letter to music. People were asked to pick a favorite song and to make an audio recording reading the lyrics. The Lyric Project then made a film based on 10 songs. Again, that's The Lyric Project Season 2, How to Say Goodbye, on Monday, November 19th at 7 p.m. at the Star Theater, 13 Northwest 6th Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
You are tuned to KBOO Portland. It's 9:02 and time to get to Veterans Voice coming right up after the rest of these messages. At 10 o'clock, we've got Valley Views today talking to artists working with CEI Artworks in Corvallis. At 10:15, it's Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. And at 11, Radio Zine features a presentation from the Mutual Aid Disaster Relief Training Team on resource extraction and disaster capitalism. And please remember that all these KBOO programs are made possible by members' support. And if you're not one and you want to become a member, you can go to kboo.fm and click where it says donate. And we're going to get to Veterans Voice in just a moment. KBOO programming is made possible by KBOO listener members and support from Cotton Cloud Natural Beds and Furniture, women owned since 1981. Providing sustainable wood furniture, locally handcrafted futons, latex, mattresses, and more using organic and natural materials. The Cotton Cloud Showroom is located at 701 Northeast Broadway in Portland, online at cottoncloudfutons.com.
We bomb everywhere, man. We bomb everywhere. Way more than our share, man. We bomb everywhere. We bomb the mountains bare, man. Found the desert air. Oh boy, don't we care, man. Cause we bomb everywhere. We've bombed in Peru, Panama, Pakistan, Yemen, Libya, Laos, Syria, Sudan, Congo, Cuba, Korea, Kuwait, Colombia, Cambodia. Ain't we great? Grenada, Nicaragua, Guatemala, Vietnam, Yugoslavia, El Salvador, Afghanistan, Japan, Bosnia, Somalia, Indonesia, Iraq, China, Iran. Time to attack, yeah, we bomb everywhere. Way more than our share. Don't think we ain't fair, cause we'll bomb everywhere. We got family values and moral majority. Peace, love, Jesus, top priority. Do unto them for they do unto us. The kingdom come in nuclear dust.
monumental profits being made for the big shareholders in the old arms trade. They lust for the dust of a mushroom cloud. It's making them all American proud. Yeah, heat seeker, bunker buster, daisy cutter, napalm, phosphorus, uranium, smart bomb, A-bomb, predator, prowler, raptor, raven, tomahawk, hellfire, flags of waving. We bomb everywhere, way more than our share. Oh boy, ain't we fair, 'cause we bomb everywhere. Our vision of peace has become a ghost, but we're number one, we bomb the most. Soldiers coming home, suicidal, we sit and watch. American Idol, Saudi, Serbia, Mexico, Kosovo, Romania, Germany, load them up, here we go, another verse. Life gets worse, just watch your show and wait for the glow. Well, someday soon we'll all have nukes, true world democracy. Extermination of all life, high possibility. Well, ask your child what they suggest to prevent mass destruction and bring this world in line with love and a brotherhood connection. De-escalate your mental state, incinerate your tools of hate, build no more weapons or rejuvenate our planet's fate. Drop food, medicine, clothes, and tools the children wish you'd see, that will win most the hearts and minds before you count to three. Then we'll bomb everywhere, man, way more than our share. Don't think we ain't fair, man, 'cause we'll bomb everywhere. We'll bomb in Peru, Panama, Pakistan, Yemen, Libya, Laos, Syria, Sudan, Congo, Cuba, Korea, Kuwait, Colombia, Cambodia. Ain't we great? Grenada, Nicaragua, Guatemala, Vietnam, Yugoslavia, El Salvador, Afghanistan, Japan, Bosnia, Somalia, Indonesia, Iraq, China, Iran, time to attack.
Sisters and brothers, welcome to Veterans Voice Radio Show on KBOO 90.7 FM in the Portland, Vancouver area, and 104.3 FM in the Willamette Valley, and 91.9 FM in the Columbia River Gorge, or on the World Wide Web at kboo.fm. And you can hear our older shows if you want at kboo.fm/veteransvoice. It's one word, Veterans Voice. I'm Marvin, and our engineer is Tammy, and she's in there working real hard. And, you know, I was just listening to the last two guests on Jenkins' show and, you know, thinking about those poor children in Gaza and in Palestine in general. And, you know, it just makes me think of how all around the world that children are really getting the worst end of stuff, you know, and it's so sad. And I know that, there was guys in my unit in Vietnam who, when we were back at like a base camp or something, that they would take soap and, you know, clothes that their families had sent for the children and go down into the villages and give the children stuff, you know, because, you know, their whole life had been turned upside. They knew nothing but war, you know, from the time they were born. They, you know, it was just completely war. And even after the war ended and guys could finally go back to Vietnam, there's a lot of groups. I went back to Vietnam and started programs, building schools and medical centers and soccer fields and, you know, helping demine the country because we left so many landmines there, you know. It's a really horrible thing. And my friend Chuck Searcy has been over there since 94, you know, working on that program of demining Vietnam and you know, he's told me about farmers and the children that have been hurt and killed by the ordnance that we left over there. And one of them that Chuck was really angry about, and it's so hard to disarm them, are these cluster bombs, the little bombettes that come out of these cluster bombs that look like little birds, you know, little birds. And they're so hard to deactivate, and kids see those and pick them up, and you know they blow up on them and hurt them really bad, and you know that's the real problem. And the other day I was reading that the military came up with a new idea for landmines, anti-personnel landmines. And what it is, it's going to be hooked to a central guy who will be monitoring them, and he can, you know, not have them explode if a child or an animal walks on them, and all of that. And I thought, that's not going to work, because they're not going to, you know, those guys are not going to wait around. And what are they going to do if they have to take off real fast and they just leave the landmines in there? And they're never going to go back and dig those landmines up. There's just no way they're going to do that. So, you know, that's just pretty horrible. And, you know, when VVA got the Nobel Vietnam Veterans of America, I believe that was Vietnam Veterans of America, got the Nobel Peace Prize because they did the campaign, you know, to get countries to demine and stop using them. And, of course, the United States never signed that. But when they won that Nobel Peace Prize, you know that Clinton never called them to congratulate them. He never called them and congratulated them for winning that Nobel Peace Prize. And I thought that was pretty horrible of him not to do that. You know, the U.S. didn't sign it, so they don't care. Something else that's really been on my mind lately, and one of them is Gaza, of course, and Palestine, and what's going on there. And it just, I asked my brother-in-law, Jeff, and he went over there. The first time he went over there, he went with Fellowship of Reconciliation. And they wouldn't, he's a minister, and they wouldn't let him off the plane, you know, they sent him right back. And the second time he went over, he got to go into Palestine, and he said it reminded him of Europe after World War II, you know. It just tore up and horrible, and, you know, even back when he did it, you know, they weren't getting good water, they weren't getting electricity all day, they weren't getting good food supplies, and children were having a lot of problems, and the elderly was having problems, and it continues to this day, and it's never stopped. And the other thing that's been bothering me a lot is Saudi Arabia bombing Yemen and using food as a weapon. You know, food is used as a weapon, believe it or not. And, you know, that's what, when they do a siege on a country or whatever, you know, that's what they do. They cut off the food supply. And that's what's, you know, Yemen's really having a problem now. They're just 14 million people are on the brink of starvation in Yemen. But the U.S. and I believe England, you know, sells weapons to Saudi Arabia, and I know U.S. sells probably the most, and especially the bombs. Of course they sell them the bombs, but the U.S. came out yesterday because of all the problems, you know, with that poor man at Khashoggi getting murdered, you know, by the Saudis in Turkey, and there's a lot of pressure on Saudi Arabia. And the U.S. is getting a lot of pressure, you know. And so they decided, well, we're not going to refuel these bombers in the air, you know, as they do their bomb runs. We're not going to, you know, use American planes and refuel these bombers. And that's just not going to work either, because the Saudis are just going to take the American planes and do it. And the planes they're using to bomb is American planes. And so, you know, they just continue to bomb. Right now, 50,000 civilians are dead from famine, you know, and I couldn't really find out how many of those were children, and I would imagine it's a huge amount that are children, and that's really a problem. 50,000 civilians dead now, and 14 million on the brink of starvation because of not getting the food that they need, you know. Using food as a weapon is just such a horrible thing. And I wanted to talk a little bit about the United States. I was talking to my friend the other day about what the U.S. has done with their nukes since they used them against the civilians at Hiroshima and Nagasaki at the end of World War II. And I was just wondering, how many times has the U.S. Threatened a country with nuclear annihilation, and you know, since World War II? And I found out that in the Korean War in the 1950s, that General MacArthur threatened to bomb not only Korea, North Korea, but also bomb China. You know, threatened to nuke China and to nuke the Northern Korea. And also Eisenhower was the president at that time, and he also was thinking about using nuclear weapons against the North and trying to get them to, you know, come to the peace table, I guess. And that hasn't worked out because the country's been divided for all these years. But it seems like now they're coming out of that. They're taking down a lot of the stuff and getting rid of some of the landmines between North and South Korea. So that's a pretty good thing. And they also thought about bombing North Vietnam with nukes. You know, the generals, General Westmoreland and his cabal in South Vietnam in the 60s, early 60s, were getting plans on moving tactical nuclear weapons into South Vietnam. And they had all these plans made up and everything, and we're going to get it going. And one of the Westmoreland and one of the people working with the government in South Korea, South Vietnam, sent a flash message into President Johnson at the time, and Johnson said, "No," he says, "end this right now. We are not going to do that. We are not going to use nukes," because they were so afraid that if they used nukes against North Vietnam, that China and Russia would come in and help the North more than they already were. The North was helping China and Russia were helping North Vietnam with armament, and I also believe food, if I remember right. And so, you know, Johnson stopped that right off, man. He just, no way. And then after Johnson got out, Nixon got elected, Nixon brought up the use of nuclear nukes against North Vietnam again. And I, you know, somebody I really despise and just have no respect for, and that's Henry Kissinger. And Henry Kissinger said, no, we can't do that. We can't use nukes against the North Vietnamese, because it would really cause, you know, again, it would cause China and probably Russia to come into the to war and help them, and that would just be a disaster. We finally got out of Vietnam, and I think in 1973 they pulled all the 99.9% of all the troops out of Vietnam, released the POWs from the North, and there was a few POWs in the South. In fact, one of them, after they released all the POWs, one POW was still there. He was in the South, and finally he got released. And after that, you know, after everybody else had got released, they said, "Whoa, we still got one guy down in the South, and we got to, you know, get him out of here." So I thought that was pretty interesting. And what else was interesting, I read in this article, and I never thought about it before, and they were making the deals with the North after the North united united Vietnam into one country, that they were negotiating with the government of Vietnam. And one of the things that they negotiated with, they asked Vietnam, do you have any American civilians there in captivity? And within, I think it was a week, they released five civilians. And that was after, you know, all the POWs had been released. There were five civilians that were, and I think that they said that some of them worked for the CIA and different organizations like that. But there was five of them that was released, and one stayed. Bobby Garwood stayed, and Bobby Garwood. It's a very interesting story about Bobby Garwood. He stayed in Vietnam after the war. And he, during the war, he was used for propaganda. Sorry, you know, they'd go to close to military bases, and he would talk and to get, you know, get guys to desert and go, you know, over to the Viet Cong, and he would guard prisoners in the South that were Viet Cong prisoners in the South. He would be a guard on them. He spoke fluent Vietnamese because he'd been there so long. He spoke fluent Vietnamese. And Bobby, I can't remember, I think it was in the 80s that Bobby was wanting to come home, so he would go from the base he was working at in the North, and he'd drive into Hanoi, and he would change his clothes into civilian clothes so he could go into where there were diplomats and everybody buying stuff. There was a special store in the North for foreigners. They could buy stuff. And Bobby had given a note to one of the reporters that was there, and the reporter, you know, let it out that there was an American there and that he wanted to come home. And so he did get released. I saw a picture of him. He was very thin, and his teeth were just horrible. And they flew him from Hanoi to, I think, Thailand. And when he was in Thailand, he got dental care and food and medical checkup and everything. And the military took control of him then because he was considered a deserter. And he was brought back, I think. He was a Marine. He was brought back, I think, to Camp Pendleton. And he went through a lot of trouble, and he was finally dishonorably discharged, and they didn't give him all that back pay that he would have had, and he finally he had a lot of personal problems in his life, and he ended up marrying, I think a couple times he got married, and I'm not sure where Bobby lives now. The last time he was living in California. So I don't know. He was a really good mechanic from what, you know, people were saying. But I don't know what happened to Bobby Garwood after that, but he was the last one. But, you know, there's so many, you know, I think there's 1,100 or 1,200 MIAs in Vietnam, and I think they've got it down. You know, they brought a lot of bodies home now, but I still think there's quite a few guys missing MIA over there. There's no POWs, but there's some MIAs. I've been over there quite a few times, and have a lot of friends that work for the government and everything, and I've asked them about it, and they said no, they don't, never heard of any POWs being left in Vietnam. And so I always thought that was, you know, because people who, you know, family member is missing. You know, you want to know what happened to them. You want to know, you want to have a burial for them. You want their bones to be brought home, and so you can end this. You know, it's got to be just so horrible, you know, that these families are waited 50 years or more, you know, for their family member to be brought home. And, you know, that's really sad. And that's what a war is about. You know, you're not gonna lose people, and families are gonna be hurt, and it's just a no-win situation. You know, I was thinking about, you know, Korea, when Americans went into Korea, there was no reason for us to go in there. You know, my uncle got killed in Korea, and he was a MIA for a while, and then they found the tank company that he was part of, and it had been completely wiped out, and his body was sent home. And that was 1951, I believe, or 52. His body was sent home. But then Vietnam, boy, there was no reason we was ever sent to Vietnam. And how about, they sent before Vietnam, they sent troops into Dominican Republic. There was no reason for that, I don't think. And then they sent them to Panama, you know, then Afghanistan, then Iraq, you know. And now they've got troops in Africa. And I was going to talk about that a little bit, them having troops in Africa. And their main base in Africa is in Djibouti. And that's their permanent base is in Africa is the Djibouti. And I don't remember how many was there. I read it, but I forgot to write it down. But, you know, there was quite a few there. And they were saying that the reason that they were there is they were to fight against the terrorists, you know, that were in that areas. And all of a sudden, you know, those four special forces guys got killed in Korea. I mean, in Djibouti, and senators and representatives, they didn't have no idea that we had troops in Africa. And they were up and, you know, angry about it. And Trump, you know, has no respect for the military at all. He's already proven that. And they told him he had to call a mother of one of these young soldiers that was killed. And you know what he said? He said, well, he knew what he was getting into, you know? He knew what he was getting into. No sympathy in this guy. You know, he had no sympathy for that family or for that soldier who had been killed, you know. And then this weekend when he flew to France for the 100th, you know, World War I has been over for 100 years, and he didn't go to one of the memorials where the soldiers are buried. You know, a bunch of American soldiers were buried, and he didn't go because it rained, you know, and everybody else went. You know, I saw pictures of people standing in the rain, you know, but he didn't go. He finally went to one, but that was only because there was so much pushback, you know. And he just does not have any respect for the military. He really doesn't. And when he was running for, you know, the highest office in America, he was saying that he knew more than the generals knew. And boy, he's sure proven that he doesn't know anything. He doesn't, you know, have any respect for the military, and especially, you know, those four guys that were killed over there. And when I was reading this thing, and U.S. threatened that the permanent base there now, and they're changing that. It was to use those bases, like I said, for fight terrorism, but they've changed it now. They changed it. Now they're going in there because they're worried about China, and they're worried about Russia, and so they've changed their mission statement. It's a threat of China, and it's a threat of Russia now instead of the threat of terrorism. Because boy, there's a lot of natural resources in Africa that hasn't been, you know, stolen or from the people in Africa, hasn't, you know, so there's a lot in there. And China, China's been going in there for a long time, and you know, they've been building roads, they've been building all kinds of different things to, you know, and they do have some military there, but they're building things, they're building and building infrastructure, roads and railway and airports and all kinds of stuff. And the U.S. is, you know, not the big boy on the block anymore in Africa. And so, you know, they can't let that happen. And China, in the South China Sea, in the Spratlys and all those islands out there, and the Spratlys especially, has a lot of oil. Boy, they got lots and lots of oil. And China's been building up some of these atolls out there in that area and made them into military bases and have ports. They've made ports there and these huge airfields that can take big jet military planes and everything. And the other countries, the Philippines and Vietnam and those countries are, Australia too, you know, are really worried about that, because that area through there is a big trading route where these, you know, the ships go, and it's a big trading route, and they're worried about China, you know, taking over that, and they, you know, and China claims that whole area. They say they've been in there for, you know, they got this huge long history of China, the U.S. has been sending ships in there to prove that, you know, that's the freedom of the seas and all that, and flying planes and stuff over that area. I don't think they flew them over those bases they built, but they've flown them over the close to them, the South China Sea, and the ships going in there, and China sent up planes and confronted them, and sent out ships and confronted them. And that could be really dangerous. That could be a really horrible flashpoint there. If they get into a shooting match there, that's just pretty poo. Because China has a military pact with Russia, and if China gets attacked, you know, Russia more than likely will support China in a lot of ways, and you know, that they're pretty strong. They're strong. And China's building up their military because, you know, I used to say that China didn't export their, you know, military, their ideology and all that, but they've started doing that in the last 20 years. And the U.S. does not like that at all. So that's a real problem. And I don't know what country it is, but it's close to Australia, and China went to them and said that we'll build you a port if we can use it, if we can use that port. And the Australia and the U.S. found out about it. Now the United States is making an offer, you know, that we'll build that for you, you know. We don't want China in there. And so that's a real problem too, because that whole area in there is very sensitive right now, and it needs to be. I think I'm going to keep my eye on it, because I really don't want to see the United States get into a shooting war with Russia or China. That would just be disastrous for not only the battlers, but the whole world. It'd be just so horrible, because both the United States and China have, you know, really big militaries, and I think China's got more men under arms than the U.S. does, and you know, that would be a real problem. Veterans Day just ended, and I got up really on the 11th, got up really early, and I went up to the Vietnam Veterans Memorial up by the zoo, And I always go really early because I want to get there before crowds get there. And I got there about 5:30 in the morning and was walking around and ran into some other guys that were out there that early too. And they were like me, you know, they didn't want to be in the crowd, you know, if they were going to have the flag waving and all of that like they've had. You know that Veterans Day used to be called Armistice Day, and it still is on many places, you know. It's called Armistice Day because that the 11th hour of the 11th month is on the 11th day is at 1918 is when they signed the armistice and the war ended. And they had been fighting since 1914. Germany and the Axis, and then England and the Allies had been fighting trench warfare since 1914. And they were, this is World War One, and they, unimaginable amount of people were killed in this war that lasted 4 years. Belgium, you know, has armistice. Belgium, France, UK, Germany, and Australia, New Zealand call it Armistice Day. It was the war to end all wars, you know. It was the Great War, and it was the war to end all wars. They weren't going to fight, you know. That was going to be the end of it. And you know that when the World War One ended, when they signed the Treaty at Versailles, it just put so much pressure on Germany. Because in it, it had that Germany had to pay reparations to the other countries, and it just drove Germany into the ground, and that's was perfect ground for the Nazis to take over, which they did, and we know what happened there in World War II. So, you know, if it was the war to end all wars, why did they give it a number, you know? World War One, why did they give it a number to be World War One? You know, I was telling Tammy that I went to have lunch on Veterans Day in a restaurant in Cornelius, and I have a bag that I carry that has Vietnam veteran things on it, you know, and I put it down and I ordered my meal and I was, you know, just having a good time and finished my meal and the waiter came up and says, "Oh no, there's someone paid for your meal," you know. And I thought, wow. And I didn't know who did it, but you know, they pay for my meal on Veterans Day. And when I got up and put my jacket on and slung my bag over my shoulder, and there was a table behind me, and there was a girl, and she was talking to these two guys, and it was pretty interesting. I didn't really hear a lot of it because I don't like to do that, you know. And so when I got up, I was facing them, and she said, "Oh, we didn't make too much noise for you, did we?" And I said, "No, it was just fine." And she said that these two guys are veterans also, and one of them had been in the Army, and the other one had been in the Marine Corps. And I asked them, did they go to Iraq or in Afghanistan? And they both of them said that they had a couple deployments, both of them to Iraq. And the Marine guy, he had gone to not only Iraq, but he had also gone to Afghanistan. And we were talking, you know, about what I thought about the wars and those wars, and they agreed that, you know, it wasn't, you know, why should they have to go all that time? And before I left, I says, "I'm glad you made it." And they both of them almost together said, yeah, I'm glad we made it also, you know. So it's pretty interesting that these guys are, you know, well, we've known it all the time that these guys weren't, you know, are getting had by having to go multiple things going over there and fighting for what, you know, nothing changed over there. It was just about the same. And these poor guys now are going to suffer for the rest of their lives, you know, with PTSD and thinking about what they had to do and what they went through. And I'm sorry for these guys that they did that they had to go do that. And we tried hard, didn't we, Tammy, not to get those guys over there, you know? And we had these huge rallies in Portland against them, against that war, huge rallies against it. And, you know, they just went ahead and did it anyway. Russia, when the World War I started, Russia was part of the Axis. They were part of the Axis and fighting on alongside of Germany and Hungary and Turkey and those folks. And they dropped out of the war at the end of 1917 because they were having a revolution within their own country. And they were calling their military back. And their military, all the complete breakdown, you know, the soldiers didn't want to be there. The officers were trying to get them to fight, and they wouldn't fight. Many officers were killed, and the guys just went home. You know, they went home. They didn't see any reason to be fighting in there when there was a revolution in their own country. They went home. And 1917, the U.S. got involved in the war, and they had been fighting for 3 years, just about 3 years when the U.S. came into the war, and they had been beating each other up so bad in the trench warfare that the trenches were about the same distance apart at the end of 1918 as they were when they started the war. Nothing had changed. The only thing that changed was that a lot of new weapons were brought into the war. The first time they used airplanes in the war. They used machine guns in the war. They used tanks in the war. I think I said it already. But they also used gas. The first time they used gas in a war. And they had, you know, so many guys got killed by gas, blinded when the gas got to them, that, you know, it just filled their lungs up, and that was it. It made them blind. It was so horrible. I saw a picture of a horse, because they were still using horses to... for supply routes and everything, and I saw a horse with a gas mask on. This poor horse had a gas mask on, and if they were running out of food or whatever, they would kill the horses, and they would slaughter the horses to have food. And I have this book. I bought this book. It was World War I pictures, and they wouldn't release this book. Would not, when it was made, the government of the U.S. would not let that book be distributed in the United States. They kept that book out of the, wouldn't let it, you know, it's just like the book Johnny Got His Gun, where they banned that book, you know, right before World War II, because it was so anti-war. And if you ever get a chance, you should read that book, Johnny Got His Gun. It's really, really interesting. And but with this book I have, it's so, the pictures are so devastating. you know, of what happened to these men in these trenches on both sides. You know, the trenches in the wintertime was, you know, muddy, and there was gas between the trenches, and the rain would come. They had trouble getting food to their soldiers. They had trouble getting everything because it was so horrible. There were so many bodies in the wire, because they used wire between, you know, barbed wire, Constantine wire between the trenches, and they would have these charges. Each side would send men just across that area to get, you know, trying to push the Germans back, or the Germans trying to push the French and the British back, and later the Americans back. And there were bodies in these on these barbed wire, and they would stop, and each side would go out and get their bodies off the wires, and but sometimes they couldn't get to them. The United States, one of the worst things was France, because France had a lot of colonies, right, at that time. So France got a lot of their soldiers from their colonies, you know, Algeria and Vietnam and places like that, and they took these soldiers and used them during World War One. I'm trying to remember now how many Vietnamese there were. There was a bunch of them, and they took them, and some of them were infantry soldiers who fought on the lines, and some of them were supply who did this, you know, supply and all that, and some were medical. But there's a graveyard in France that's nothing but Vietnamese soldiers that had been killed in the war. A lot, you know, it's a pretty big one, and all of these were Vietnamese soldiers that were, you know, killed during the war. And so, and England, I think England too, brought some of their soldiers, got some of their colony folks in to fight the war too. And one of the things, you know, people that study World War One, the war to end all wars, the Great War to end all wars, and they try to say that it started because King Ferdinand was murdered, and that's part of it. But you know what got all these different countries involved? It is with treaties. You know, England had a treaty with France, Germany had a treaty with Turkey. You know, just all these treaties brought all these countries together in these wars against each other. So there was, you know, there were guys fighting there that had, you know, nothing to do with Germany or nothing to do with France or England. You know, they were just brought into that war because they, you know, were a colony. And treaties bring a lot of problems, you know, to brought all these guys into a war. And the, you know, the number of people who were killed in that war, 5 million were killed in World War One. 5 million. 12 million were wounded. And a lot of those that were killed, the U.S. had 53,000 were killed, and 206,000 were wounded, and a lot of the Allies that were killed were civilians. Civilians have just this, you know, devastating amount of deaths. Usually it's more than the soldiers that were fighting the war that was killed. Like in Vietnam, you know, more civilians were killed than soldiers on both sides. The North and the South were fighting. The civilians, you know, and as time goes on, as time has gone on, and the weaponry have got so, you know, terrible, really, and civilians are the ones that, you know, do the brunt of it, that get killed. than the soldiers, you know. And civilians to some countries are a target. They're a target because they believe that if they cause so many deaths of the civilians, that the civilians will, you know, overthrow the government that they're, you know, and end the war. But that usually doesn't happen. And so, you know, and there were, in the United States, sent a lot of soldiers, you know, African American soldiers into World War II. And a lot of them, there was a bunch of them from Portland. They were called the Portland Bunch. And they were African American soldiers who were sent to fight in World War One. And in fact, one of them, one of the guys, soldiers that won the Medal of Honor, was from Portland, and his name was Wilson Jones, and he won Academy Award. He won a Medal of Honor for his bravery in World War One, and a lot of those guys were infantry soldiers. A lot of them, you know, were in supply, and a lot of them, you know, were in just these different support groups. But a lot of them were in the infantry, fought in the infantry, and a lot of them died. Boy, a lot of them died. About 350,000, I think it was, served of black soldiers. Served in World War One, and I couldn't find how many had been killed. I couldn't find out how many had been killed, but I'm still working on that one. But I just, you know, I think about it. In World War One, the war to end all wars, you know, the Great War was going to end all wars. And here we go, you know, World War II, Vietnam, Korea, Iraq, Afghanistan, Panama, you know, it just keeps going and going and going. And now, like I said before, Africa, you know, it just keeps going and going and going. In Europe, even here now, there's a big thing on Veterans Day. Here in Armistice Day in those other countries, where they sell poppies, you've seen them, these little red poppies you can buy, and the money's used for veterans groups. And I always wondered why they did poppies, and what it is the poppies is the only thing that would grow right after the war on the battlefields with poppies. And so that became a sign of the war, was these poppies. And so they used that money for veterans. I don't think there's any World War One veterans left now. I think they've all passed on. And now the World War Two veterans are going pretty fast too. And also Korean veterans are passing away pretty fast. And sad to say, but Vietnam vets are dying off really fast. I was surprised. I read this article about Vietnam veterans and how fast we're dying off from cancers and diabetes and you know, just these different kind of cancers, you know, and diseases. And it was brought on, of course, and we know, by Agent Orange. And there's this big push now to have the VA test the children and grandchildren of Vietnam vets, because there's a real problem with the family members now of Vietnam veterans. And I always call it the illness that keeps on giving. You know, it not only made us sick, but now it's making our families sick and our grandchildren sick. And how long is it going to go before, you know, that doesn't do that anymore? And I'm really worried about that. We had on our show years ago a couple of women who were children of soldiers that had Agent Orange. And, boy, that was, you know, something. I was depressed after that show for a while. And one of them, the women, had gone back to Vietnam and spent time with the folks over there that were, you know, ill from Agent Orange. And the United States finally helped clean up a base in, I think it was in Da Nang in Vietnam, that was used by Operation Ranch Hand, was the ones that did spraying of Agent Orange. And they finally cleaned that up as best they could. And there's another one down outside of Saigon that I think that they're working on now, that so contaminated that they can't, you know, there's nothing going to grow on that land. I don't think it's ever going to be open for any kind of, you know, use at all. Just like there's some land in France and Belgium that still they're not able to use because of the gas that was put there, and they can't use it because it is so contaminated that they can't use that land anymore. And boy, that just something, you know. You guys remember Bill Byers, I'm sure. You know, Bill was my friend. He passed away. He was a Korean veteran. He was also an atomic veteran from the nuclear testing down in the Nevada test sites. And we talked a lot about that down there. And he lived his early life. He grew up in Washington, D.C. And, you know, back in the, he was born in the 20s, you know. He was a pretty old guy. And he said that he'd go to the old soldiers' home, and he would talk to the World War One veterans. And he said there were even a few Civil War veterans at that time. And I thought that was pretty interesting. And he said, yeah, he said they were really, really, really old guys. But he talked to the World War One guys a lot. And he said that they didn't really, you know what they were fighting for over there. And you know, they just, some of them were there because they had been gassed during the war, and they were having trouble, lung troubles, and were getting treatment from the VA at their old soldier's home, you know, trying to help them. Bill said there were a lot of guys there with legs had been, you know, blown off, or arms had been blown off. And he said that they were all in wheelchairs. Those, you know, a lot of them were in wheelchairs, and he, you know, he said that really let him know what a war is about. You know, the war that average Americans don't see. You know, they don't see that, what happens to people that go to war. They don't see all the arms that are blown off, or legs that are blown off, or whatever. They just don't see it. And I think if more people saw it, they would be less eager to send their children to war. You know, I think that would be, you know, just go up to the VA on the hill. Take a look at that, you know. Take a look at the guys up there. I was there one day I can't remember what I was up there for, but I walked by the place where they fixed the prosthetics, you know, and here was a young man with both his legs had been blown off, and one of his arms had blown off, and it was in Iraq, you know. And I sat and talked to him for quite a while, and he wanted to talk about what happened to him. And he was in a Humvee that got hit by an IED, and it, you know, he said that he had a lot of problems hearing for a while, but he could hear now. And here he was, you know. And look, yeah, we're running out of time now, and And I just wanted to tell you guys that, you know, I'm sorry, guys, all of us, that we really have to really work on this. We cannot let, you know, send our children to war. And I just hope that people start thinking about that a little more. And we'll be back on December 21st at 9 a.m., and there it is.
Battle of New Orleans at the end of the early British wars. The young land started growing, the young blood started flowing, but I ain't a marching anymore. For I've killed my share of engines in a thousand different fights. I was there at the little big horn. I heard many men lying, I saw many more dying, but I ain't a marching anymore.
KBOO Community Radio is hiring a development director. This 32-hour-a-week position develops and implements the yearly fundraising plan, develops promotional and press materials, and supports the anti-oppression work of KBOO. Send a cover letter and resume to Delphine Crescenzo at del@kboo.org or send to KBOO Development Hire, 20 Southeast 8th, Portland, Oregon 97214. Please answer in the cover letter the question, why is KBOO important? Deadline to apply is Sunday, November 25th at midnight. More information on the development director position is available at kboo.fm/developmenthire2018.
Yo. Yo.